guys involved and all the kids who want to see them can check them out.
Cephalosaurus?
I am a paleontologist. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am. I am a paleontologist. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am. All right, that was They Might Be Giants with I Am a Paleontologist. Arguably an animal tune, certainly for those of us living with a seven-year-old. That'll ease us in today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Dr. Armeti May, a vegan veterinarian based in Los Angeles who's heading to Florida in March to give some talks, including one in Tampa. We'll find out more about Dr. May, her philosophy, and those talks when we speak to Dr. Armeti May in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to the Southeast Women's Performing Arts Festival. And we'll have a brief chat with Linda Sheehan, founder of Gulfport's Get Rescued event, taking place this Saturday. Right now, though, it's time for animal news and announcements. We'll look at items of interest in animal news locally, regionally, nationally, sometimes internationally, as well as announcements of local events. So let's turn now to interesting and or notable developments in animal news. We also welcome your comments, which you can share on the air instantly by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. So, talk turkey, as it were. Produced by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department, our first item comes really almost on the heels of something that we got at the late-breaking bulletin last week, but didn't get a chance to mention it, but luckily there's been some other developments, by which I refer to taking this item particularly from the New York Times, Dateline Tokyo. Japan will cut short this year's annual whale hunt in the Antarctic Ocean after disruption by an environmental group largely prevented its ships from killing whales, the government said Friday. The Agricultural Ministry, which runs Japan's widely criticized research whaling program, said harassment by the group, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, had kept its catch far below its annual target of whales. A spokesman for the ministry said on Friday that 170 minke whales and two fin whales have been caught this season, far below the annual targets of 850 minke and 50 fin. The recall of Japan's fleet is the first time that environmentalists have succeeded in cutting short the annual hunts, which Japan says are necessary for scientific research. Critics say the hunts are an effort to evade a global moratorium on commercial whaling. And on a related note, New York Post and others have run pieces sort of wondering aloud if a TV show essentially forced Japan to suspend its whaling operations. The Sea Shepherd, the ship featured in the Animal Planet series Whale Wars, has become so successful at harassing whaling ships at sea that activist groups are saying the TV show is at least partially responsible for ending whaling as a modern industry. So, and it says, been said a number of times, Sea Shepherd Captain Paul Watson has noted, I'm probably the only reality star that's trying to put himself out of the business in TV. And that's another great triumph, it looks like, for the Sea Shepherd folks, and we may well speak to Captain Watson again here on Talking Animals. He's been a guest a few times over the years, and this might be as good a time as any for a return visit from him. Moving on to something from the Orlando Sentinel. Sad on a number of levels, I'm afraid. Hundreds of students turned out for a Sunrise Memorial Service for a Tampa Bay teen killed in a bull riding accident. Brooke Ann Coates died Friday after being thrown from a bull and kicked in the chest. The Review High School sophomore was riding at the 301 Rodeo in Tampa. She was able to stand and walk out of the ring, but then she had trouble breathing and collapsed. Brief counselors were available at her high school on Monday. And, that's probably enough said there. Now, a few weeks back here on Talking Animals and other times prior to that, but at that point in particular, we spoke with Barbara Lopresti, who's been spearheading an effort to get an anti-tethering, dog tethering ordinance happening here in Hillsborough County. And important to note that tonight, the Animal Advisory Board will announce their final decision regarding the tethering language that Director of Animal Services Bill Armstrong has created. So it's an important meeting if you can at all get over there to attend. It's at County Center Building, second floor, 601 East Kennedy Boulevard. It's in Tampa, of course, 33602, if you're mapping it or requesting it or whatever. It doesn't say here, but it's presumably at 6:30 p.m. I think that's when most of the other meetings like this have been. So if you're not keen on the idea of dogs being chained up and tied up for too long, then this might be a chance for you to step right over and help turn things around on this final meeting here tonight. All right, let's skip that one as well. Dayline Yorba Linda, California, near my old stomping grounds, certainly within Orange County, California. I took this from no less an authority than Vending Times. Lobster zones remain in operation in two Southern California restaurants, but have been removed from another local venue following public demonstrations against the seafood crane machine organized by Orange County People for Animals. As of mid-February, the game remains in operation at Wardlow's, a thriving restaurant in Long Beach, despite being the target of a demonstration in late December and beyond. My customers don't even want me to consider removing it, the owner said. And anyways, it goes on from there. But basically what this is sort of a vending machine operation, sort of like you would see at a arcade where a kid could maybe pull out a, you know, stuffed animal or some other prize with a kind of a crane thing, except in this case, it's a live lobster in there. Okay, save that further comment. From the L.A. Times, a couple days ago, San Diego officials said most of the 400 birds found when they broke up a large cockfighting ring will have to be euthanized. Lieutenant Dan D'Souza of the San Diego County Animal Services said officials have no other choice because the birds have been trained to be aggressive. At least they will receive a humane death rather than a horrible death during a fight, he said. Seven people were arrested over the weekend, four on suspicion of owning birds trained for fighting, and three for allegedly watching a cockfight when an animal services officer arrived Saturday in rural Rainbow. Rainbow is a community about 2,000, just about 50 miles north of San Diego. And one last time to remind you that Dr. Neil Bernard, founder of Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and a guest a while back on Talking Animals and luminary by every measure, will be in town Sunday, February 27th at Ballrooms A and B at the Marshall Center of the USF campus at from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m., giving a talk called Food is Medicine. There will also be a reception and some eats and stuff afterwards. So you can go to floridavoicesforanimals.org to find out more information, including ticket prices, etc. So be sure to check that out. He's amazing. And finally, once again, wrapping things up with a little update about the Talking Animals Festival. First of all, stealing a page from Flea, as I'm often want to do, would like to offer that if anyone would like us to send out one or more beautiful posters, Talking Animals Festival posters, designed by artist extraordinaire Mike Beardsley, just give us a call. Be able to answer at certain points in the show, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. Let us know where to send them, and we'll send you off. And you can see those also at the Talking Animals website, talkinganimals.net. Just click on the little festival border banner, sorry. And you can not only see the poster there, but you can also download a smaller 8.5x11 version. But the ones that we could send you out would be 17x11 in gorgeous full color. So we're happy to do that. And want to unveil, speaking of Flea, been working on this with him, our lineup of bands performing at the Talking Animals Festival, which again will be April 3rd, Sunday, April 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And we're going to have vendors and tablers and great food and speakers and contests. And, of course, Dogs on Leashes are welcome. It's free to attend. There's so many cool things, including the music. All these bands will be there playing animal songs. Bands will include the Sandy Atkinson Band, Pete Gallagher, Bird Street Players, Sons of Hippies, Loris Vidal and Kelly McRae, Rayzilla's PBS, Ronnie Elliott, Tribal Style, The Sun Society, The Dirty Spoons and Trash Review, which consists of Judy Tampa and Bunko Squad, and Natty Moss Bunt and Friends, and also Magadog. So we're rolling from blues to folk to funk R&B, reggae, world experimental, folk pop, ska, who knows what else. All animal songs all the time. So again, that's April 3rd, Talking Animals Festival. Should be a blast. Hope you'll join us. If you'd like to be a vendor or a tabler, again, you can go to talkinganimals.net. Look up for the little festival banner. Click on that, and there's information and forms you can download to apply for those things. You can always email with any questions of any kind to talkinganimals@wmnf.org. All right, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Jeff Wayne with a piece called The Wolf, the Bear, and the Alligator on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
One of the reasons I wanted to become a comedian when I was a kid, because I would watch them on TV, and they always seemed to be happy. And I always wanted to be happy. And I started reading about comedians, and they travel, and I always wanted to travel. And believe me, when you get an act like mine, you travel. But being a comedian has allowed me to see most of the United States, a lot of Europe and Asia. And it's been very enjoyable, sometimes not real exciting. And I was in Hawaii when they had Hurricane Iniki. It was horrible. And what was funny about that is the next week I had to go to Anchorage, Alaska. I get off the plane and the guy greeting me goes, "Were you the comedian in the hurricane?" "Yeah." "Well, we have an active volcano alert here." There was a big volcano with smoke belching out of it. I said, "This is great. I can read the newspaper. Comedian survives hurricane, killed by volcano." So I get to the condo, I unpack, and I thought, well, I'm going to go out and take a walk and take a look at Alaska. Look outside, there's a wolf out there. I call the condo manager. "Hey, there's a wolf out there." "Well, that's Ray." "What do I care what his name is? I didn't travel 2,000 miles to be on a first-name basis with a wolf." "Oh, he's a pet. Just call him to you." This isn't the object of what my desire is. I'm afraid of this thing. So I stayed in the condo all that week because this pet wolf's out running around. I'm not tangling with a wolf. Volcanoes, hurricanes, I'm not Hercules. The next week, I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska. Now, this is incredible. Very small city. I can't wait to get out and look around. And the club manager tells me, "Now, listen, don't go on the outskirts of town. There's bears. They'll attack you." What's happening here? He says, "Sometimes they come in this city and attack people." So this is terrible. So if one sees you, act like you're dead. I said, "Brother, I won't have to act. He'll just come over and sniff you for a little while. He's not going to be smelling me long, I'll tell you that." Said he's going to test to see if you're dead or not. He's going to take his paw and bang you in the chest a couple times, but don't make any noise. Do you know how big a bear's paw is? Cracking my ribs, make no noise? This is like being married. Oh! So he said, "Well, if you can't act like you're dead, then find a hill to run down." Now imagine this. You're out here. Here's a bear. And you're supposed to say, "Stop. Let me find a hill. I don't know the geography of this area. Why do I want to run down a hill?" Well, the bear's front legs are shorter than his back legs, and he can't run down the hill. That's right. He'll roll and be waiting for me at the bottom. A month later, I'm in Miami, Florida, and I'm playing golf. We're next to a canal. I see this thing that looks like a log move. Uh-oh, watch out. I said, what is that? That looks like an alligator. The guy next to me.
That's a gator.
Keep your eye on that ball. I'm going to keep my eye on that alligator. Brother, that's a handicap right there. And none of these people seem that nervous about any of this. So I said to him, I said, well, I guess, you know, you're sort of comfortable because we can outrun that alligator.
Oh, no, no, no.
Alligator goes 35 miles an hour, fast as a man, knocks you over with the tail, grabs you with the teeth, drags you under the water, drowns you, and eats you for a couple days. I don't need this information. I came out a crappy golfer. Now I'm winding up a human snack bar. But if the alligator starts to run after you, zigzag, because he can't zig, that's it, stop. His name is Ray, run down the hill, it's over.
All right. That's Jeff Wayne with a piece called The Wolf, the Bear, and the Alligator, taken from his CD, The Jeff Comedy Jam. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. There's all kinds of stuff available there. Info on the festival, links for our Facebook page, Twitter feed, etc. All right, it's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Dr. Armighty May. As I mentioned earlier in the show, Dr. May is a vegan veterinarian based in Los Angeles whose practice involves making house calls, and she may also have a novel perspective in that she's also a very active animal advocate who regularly does vegan outreach in Southern California. Dr. May will be traveling to Florida in March to deliver some talks, including one in Tampa for Florida Voices for Animals at the Loving Hut Restaurant, March 6th at 4:30 p.m. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Dr. Armighty May to Talking Animals. Welcome, Dr. May.
Thank you, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, let's first, so many things that we want to cover. Let's first find out a little bit about your background. Now, how early on did you decide, you know what, I'm going to be a veterinarian?
Very early on, from as young as I could talk, I knew I wanted to be a vet. So I just stuck with it, and here I am today. It was a long journey, a lot of obstacles I had to face and overcome, especially in vet school with regard to animal use issues I confronted there. But, you know, I got through it. So.
Sure. Well, I definitely want to delve into those in a moment or two. But, you know, I mean, I think we all know kids of all stripes and sometimes all ages sort of entertain thoughts of becoming veterinarians. And then usually reality in some form kind of tends to intrude. Usually it's
right.
The academic rigors involved on the undergraduate level or other factors. I mean,
sure.
It sounds like your path was pretty direct and pretty determined. Maybe you could sort of describe just exactly how from that time as a young kid you sort of blazed that path, and it sounds like you didn't let up till you were there.
Right. Yeah, so I, you know, really was focused on school up through undergrad and getting good grades, and then I got several different types of experience at different veterinary settings, about 1,000 hours of experience before applying to vet school, which is considered standard. And, of course, I had to take the GRE, so that was a requirement for most vet schools.
Sure. Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, when I was applying, I also had to think about how I was going to be perceived by the admissions committee, because after speaking with some vet students, came to realize that they do sometimes look down upon people who have animal rights sympathies, and yet honesty is also something very important to me. So I figured that I would leave out the activism from my admission or application packet, and therefore they didn't ask me certain questions that could have otherwise caused a problem in my interview.
Okay, well, cool. Yeah, I definitely want to come back to that because that's something you really seem to note, for example, on your website where you offer advice to aspiring vet students. So I think that's really interesting. But I think it might also be great if we have just a little more context for that and find a little bit more about you sort of leading up to the vet school phase. So for example, were you all – like you said you decided you want to be a vet early on. So I assume that you're probably one of those kids that was always – caring for animals, bringing them home, tending to them?
Yeah, I grew up with dogs and cats, and I used to really love hanging out with the dogs at my dad's house up in Malibu, and there would be a whole neighborhood of dogs that would kind of roam around the neighborhood, and I remember picking ticks off the dogs with my bare hands. I was just really into it, and I would also pet sit for neighbors on occasion. So, yeah, I always had an affinity for them, and my mom raised me vegetarian, so I had an awareness of animal issues to some degree growing up. But it wasn't until I went to college that I went vegan after reading Diet for a New America that I really realized the full extent of factory farming.
Sure.
And that strengthened my resolve to become a vet, too, since I realized that would help me advocate for them even more effectively.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a lot of the sort of roots of what you do now and how you live your life and how you, you know, sort of do outreach of various kinds, which we'll also get into a bit more in a moment. You know, really, the roots of those came very, very early on. I mean, it sounds like pretty much across the board. I mean, between the way your mom raised you and your own interest and how you sort of acted on that, it sounds like sort of precocious in multiple ways.
Yes.
So this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Dr. Armighty May, a veterinarian who's also a vegan and animal advocate. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Dr. May a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. So then really along the lines of what you're saying and what we kind of established that you were sort of, you know, early on with many of these things, Do you feel like you're almost maybe an animal advocate before you kind of even fully, you know, knew what that meant? Just again because of the early interest and the way your mom raised you, and sounds like you kind of were doing those things before maybe it was even identified as such, at least for yourself.
Well, I wasn't as aware of a lot of the cruelty that goes on in the factory farms, especially until I read Diet for New America, and after that I read a lot of other books like Vegan, the New Ethics of Eating by Eric Marcus, as well as Mad Cowboy by Howard Lyman. So
Sure. Once
I was more in tune with that, I really became a lot more active than I was before. But even as a high school student, I was pretty staunch in my vegetarianism and was not a fan of, you know, some of the events that went on that involved barbecues and so on, which I guess is probably natural for most people who lean towards vegetarianism.
Sure. And where did you grow up? Because you mentioned earlier, picking ticks off of animals and stuff. So I mentioned nowhere.
Well, that was in Malibu. My dad lives in Malibu, and I grew up in Santa Monica, my mom's place.
Okay.
And then I would see my dad on the weekends in Malibu. So
oh, okay.
I grew up, you know, kind of in both places.
Okay,
yeah.
I guess I was picturing something a little more rustic than Malibu, but okay.
Well, yeah, dogs can get ticks up there too.
Sure, no, yeah. No, I just was picturing something very different. But so at this point, you sort of, you know, present yourself, and we've obviously billed you today as you know, a vegan veterinarian. And it sounds like, really, from what you were starting to say a bit earlier when I wanted to kind of circle back around to this, that you were also, really, for all intents and purposes, a vegan vet student, but that you felt like you needed to be sort of careful about, you know, treading lightly within the confines of vet school.
Yeah, well, it all started when I was confronted with the section in my undergrad biology class, and that raised a whole host of issues for me because it got me thinking to what I would be facing in vet school. So I ended up talking to a student at a vet school who informed me about terminal surgeries, which, for those who aren't familiar, it's where they take animals who are healthy and put them under anesthesia as a training exercise for vet students and then kill them at the end of the procedure, whatever surgery they think they need to learn or, you know, teach the students. So that is clearly an ethical problem, especially since vet students are there to learn how to heal animals, not hurt them.
Yeah.
And so it creates a lot of problems, and we're seeing a progression towards more ethical methods used, especially with regard to terminal surgeries being phased out.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a student at UC Davis, where I went to vet school, they were still having the terminal surgeries in the small animal surgery curriculum in the elective portion, which wasn't required for students to take, but a lot of students felt pressure to take it because they thought that if they didn't, then they wouldn't be adequate surgeons upon graduation or they would miss out on opportunities and things like that. That's how some students felt, not everyone.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there, I became involved with the Student Animal Welfare Committee, and one of the main things that we focused on was this Ethical Source Cadaver Program, which was an alternative to the terminal surgeries. And we organized a surgery training wet lab in which these cadavers, which were basically the bodies of dogs and cats, donated after they were either euthanized for medical reasons or died of natural causes,
mm-hmm.
were donated to the program. So those were used for surgery training.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result of that wet lab, as they call it, it's basically a training experience, a lot of students remarked they wouldn't feel obliged to take this terminal surgery course. And then after that, they discontinued it the following year. So that was a good thing that that happened. And now they've actually replaced that with a live survival surgery training where faculty supervise the students, and they're doing surgeries that the animals actually need, and they're generally low-income clients who bring those animals because they get a discounted rate since the students are doing the surgery, but it's all done under faculty supervision, and of course it's, you know, part of the students' training as well. So it's kind of a win-win all around.
Sure. Well, it sounds like, you know, just in what you've cited there, some significant progress has been made at UC Davis. I mean, there's a section on your website that I've alluded to where you are providing info and kind of advice generally to aspiring vets, and including that those folks are vegan or animal rights advocates, that unless you're applying to a very progressive vet school, it's best not to disclose this in the application or interview process. So I guess two questions. One is, how openly, you know, did you share your beliefs, or did you pretty much, sounds like, kept those, you know, under wraps? And how progressive, at the time at least, was UC Davis? And it sounds like it's certainly become, you know, a good deal more so in what you just outlined.
Yeah, so I would say definitely show concern for animal welfare, and I did so in my application, essay, and interview.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to animal rights, though, I would tread lightly because that is a hot button issue for the veterinary field in general, and I think vet schools tend to become alarmed when they hear that a student or, you know, prospective student is into animal rights, because there have been a number of cases at various vet schools where students have objected to terminal use or harmful use of animals in the curriculum, and it's blown up into a big legal fiasco, and I know of a couple students or former students who had to deal with pretty big nightmares at their schools on account of the animal use that was going on there. So I think that's one reason why they're somewhat leery,
mm-hmm.
and also they don't want to be quote unquote bothered by having someone who has controversial views.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Sure, sure.
They have it that way. But I guess that's how I would say is to play it safe. But there are a few vet schools that are becoming more progressive, like Western University of Health Sciences in Pomona, California,
mm-hmm.
which is the newest vet school in the United States. It's the 28th vet school. And they have actually a reverence for life philosophy, which is amazing. And so they don't have any harmful or terminal use of animals in their curriculum. So a place like that, I think the student can afford to be more open about her views on animal issues.
Sure.
Also, Tufts University in Massachusetts is a lot more progressive.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just the whole spectrum, and I mean, there's still schools out there that do terminal surgeries. I think it's becoming less common. There's a website put up by a fellow vegan vet who lives in the UK, Dr. Andrew Knight, called learningwithoutkilling.info, which has really good information for students, not only vet students, but anyone in the sciences who's confronted with these sorts of issues and is looking for resources to help in finding, you know, alternate paths and presenting options to professors who may not have humane options at the ready.
Well, so this is all, I think, really, really interesting, and I guess one thing that then kind of occurs to me as you're talking here is, I mean, how do you think, you know, being a vegan or obviously a long, long, long time animal advocate, has has shaped the way that you practice veterinary medicine?
Well, it's certainly made for some selective hiring and interview practices. I've interviewed a number of places when I first started out, and one of the things that came up in the interview was convenience euthanasia, which most clinics don't do anymore, but it has been an issue in the past. The other thing that's come up a lot is declawing of cats, which I refuse to do, and it's actually an amputation of the digit of a cat's toes, which is a very painful and potentially crippling procedure. I had a colleague of mine perform one of those when I was first out in practice at a multi-doctor hospital, and that cat ended up becoming lame because the bandages were tied on so tightly. The cat's blood was circulation was cut off to the leg.
Ugh.
Unfortunately, yeah. So,
yeah.
And then sometimes cats can develop fighting behaviors, house soiling behaviors. So it's really a terrible thing, which is starting to become banned in a number of cities in California.
Yeah. Well, we had just a couple of weeks ago, we had Dr. Conrad on the show. She's been on the show a number of times over the years.
Oh,
so,
great.
So,
yeah. I've worked with her. She's a friend and colleague of mine. So.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So that's been one of the issues that's come up that's, I guess, somewhat limited the types of practices that I've worked at because of various hospitals' policies concerning that. And also the thing of just if one is working in a clinic where other doctors are doing the declaws, even if I'm not doing them, it creates a little bit of tension and kind of disagreement. And
sure. Well, there's an implied endorsement probably on some level, too, that if you're part of that practice.
So if a client were to come to me for just a regular pre-surgical exam on their cat and the cat is destined to be declawed, then at some of these clinics where I said pretty upfront in the interview, listen, I'm not going to be doing these procedures, they kind of wanted to know from me, well, would I be okay with doing a pre-op exam on a cat and kind of keeping mum about my opinion about the procedure, essentially. So that wasn't something that was likely to go over so well. So I kind of had to leave those opportunities. But
well,
it's been pretty good overall. I mean, I don't feel like I've been severely limited because of my views. There might have been a few jobs here and there where I ended up not taking the job, but overall, now especially that I do house calls and relief work as an independent contractor, I have somewhat more control over, what type of medicine I'm able to practice.
Sure, yeah. Well, I got the sense at least, and maybe it's not as complete a picture as it should be, that you were sort of practicing kind of on your own and in terms of the going around doing house calls, some of this stuff. So I guess I did feel like you, probably for these exact reasons, perhaps were
sure.
Sort of operating pretty independently, with all those other factors in mind, Brett.
Sure. Yeah. When I first started out 5.5 years ago, of course, I was working as an employee for 20 months at the first hospital I worked at, and then I was still doing some interviewing at various clinics before I settled on working for myself as a house call vet and doing the relief work. So I've been doing that for about 3 years now.
Yeah.
And there are some places that I do that I have worked at in the past as a relief doctor where some of those procedures have gone on. And it just sometimes it's an issue that can come up, not just with respect to declawing, but also pain management and surgery cases and various other issues, client communication and so forth. So it does help to have one's own practice because, a lot of things can be better managed that way.
Sure. Well, and so before you did go off on your own, it sounds like, especially with the declaw thing, that was particularly sort of, pronounced and just awkward at times. I mean, what sort of other contrast, did you see then or at least that you're aware of even now? Are there just a lot of kind of really defined factions within the veterinary medicine world and to some of those factions, like, say, hey, I do declaw, and hey, I am so opposed to declaw. I mean, do factions kind of shun each other, or still kind of try to coexist fairly peacefully, or are there just too many sort of philosophical gulfs at times to really make that happen?
Yeah, it's tricky sometimes. When the declaw bans were being passed in California late 2009, Jenny Conrad and I were, and other animal advocates were at various city council meetings, and it was funny because we would show up to the meetings, and then these anti-declaw ban proponents who were against the bans were there, you know, speaking as well, and some of them were veterinarians, so it was a little bit strange to have that contrast.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for the most part, there aren't that many vets who will come out and say, point blank, that they're completely opposed to a ban, even though they may not be for the ban per se. But a lot of vets have the mentality that they want it to be reserved as a last resort.
Sure.
The problem with that reasoning, though, is that a lot of the cats who are declawed end up being relinquished to shelters because of the behavioral problems,
right,
and the biting and the so forth that happens.
Yeah, it's a horrible irony that really kind of unfolds,
yeah,
there for sure.
So the reasoning they use really doesn't hold water.
Right. Well, beyond even the declaw thing, I guess I'd be curious to know, in your case, for example, like, are there also factions like that sort of have some difficulty with people who are veterinarians that are also vegan animal advocates? I mean, do you find that much, or is that kind of less of an issue?
Yeah, it's become more apparent. There are more vegan veterinarians I've met in the last year or two,
mm-hmm,
than I knew were out there. There's still a minority amongst the veterinary profession, and I keep wondering what I can do to get more veterinarians to go vegan, and it's one of the things that I hope to be able to influence more someday. I guess what I do on a personal level is I carry vegan outreach brochures with me, and when people feel interest, or when I feel that other people are receptive, I'll hand them a brochure. That goes for clients and staff. But again, it's more just on an individual basis.
Sure.
And then, you know, once I have a standing clinic, wherever that is, I would like to incorporate that more into the practice.
Right. Well, and also, too, I understand that you do, beyond what you've just described kind of more informally, that you do vegan outreach in sort of various parts of Southern California. And along those lines, I understand that at least some of the time when you're doing that, you wear a T-shirt that says Vegetarian Veterinarian Association because good doctors don't eat their patients. So,
right. Yeah.
That probably gets some attention. That's good.
Yeah. Well, I do the vegan outreach on 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica every couple weeks with some other activists in town. And we have a video showing of Meet Your Meat at Earthlings, which we sometimes narrate parts of,
sure,
the public. So that's a good outreach that we do that I think definitely gets a lot of attention from passersby, and we distribute the vegan outreach brochures while,
sure,
we're doing that.
Well, and then we're sort of nearing the end of our time here, Dr. May, but on a sort of different level of kind of outreach, want to discuss, of course, that you're coming to Florida in March, and
yes.
So part of the reason, the fact that I sought this interview with you was sort of as a prelude to the little sort of speaking tour that you'll be on, and that's going to bring you to Tampa, for example, March 6th, 4:30 p.m. at Loving Hut, and that's under the auspices of Florida Voices for Animals, and a few other dates, including in or near Orlando on March 10th at also the Loving Hut in Orlando.
That's at 7 o'clock March 10th with, mm-hmm, Animal Rights Foundation of Florida.
Right.
And then I have an engagement at the Centers for Animal Therapies on Friday, March 11th at 7 o'clock.
Right, and sounds like still a couple pending in between those two points in Miami that might be March 8th or 9th, because I know a lot of people listen to the show online. So will those be sort of posted, the details of that be posted on your website, which, by the way, is veganvet.net? Would people be able to kind of get some of those details there of your
I could post them there. That's that's something I could ask my web assistant to help me with.
Yeah, might be good just because people, you know, sort of get wind that you're coming or hear the show today. I'm sure they'd like to, you know, come meet you and hear some more. So in our remaining time, I know that one of the things that you're likely to talk about on some of those talks, and it sounds like you kind of informally sort of tailor them for a certain group or a particular interest that that group might hold. But I gather one element of some of these talks may be about putting cats and dogs on vegan diets. And back to sort of the issues and debates that often mark the veterinary world. I mean, to what extent do you feel this is a kind of a debated issue itself in veterinary circles?
Well, with respect to dogs, there's some debate, but not as much as there is with cats, and with good reason, because cats are considered obligate carnivores, whereas dogs are omnivores.
Mm-hmm.
So it is harder for cats to thrive on a vegan diet, but it can be done as long as certain parameters are closely observed, such as their urine pH, especially with male cats who are prone to crystals in the urine. If they have alkaline urine pH, which is more likely to happen on a plant-based diet, and in those males, they can actually become blocked, which is a life-threatening emergency if that happens. And so it's important for clients who want to put their cats on a vegan diet to be ultra observant and get the urine checked regularly. For dogs, it's not as much of an issue because they're not as prone to that type of problem, and they tend to not be as picky eaters as cats are too, so that helps. But also, I've actually recommended from a health basis a vegetarian diet to a number of my canine patients who had skin allergies. And I remember one Jack Russell Terrier I treated last year who had just really itchy skin like you wouldn't believe, and he improved dramatically by switching to a vegan diet.
Well, that's great, but it sounds like once again the key thing is sort of the care with which those diets are introduced to those animals. I remember, speaking of Tufts, we had Dr. Dodman on a while back, and sort of in the wake of editing that most recent book of his, Good Old Dog. And one of the things that came up in that conversation, because it comes up in the book, is that people who put their dogs on a vegetarian diet can be doing them a disservice. And then there were some instances, cited there that diet even caused heart disease, back to, weird irony. So, again, I think the key thing is to be very careful and really closely work with your vet about
sure. There are a few breeds of dogs where there can be risk for something called dilated cardiomyopathy, which is a type of heart condition. But there are just a few select breeds, Doberman Pinscher, Schnauzers, Cocker Spaniels, and a couple other breeds. But most mixed breeds and certainly typical breeds that people have are not going to have that problem. If one does have a dog breed that is at risk, then it's recommended to supplement with taurine and or carnitine.
Cool. Well, Dr. May, we are, I think, now at the end of our time, but I really, really thank you for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. And, again, the website is veganvet.net. And as far as I can tell, the first stop on your Florida speaking tour is March 6, 4:30 p.m. at Loving Hut, again, under the auspices of Florida Voices for Animals and others beyond that, which in the next day or two may well be on the website, veganvet.net. So thanks again for your time
and all
your good work. All right.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to the Southeast Women's Performing Arts Festival happening on the campus of Tampa Prep starting March 19th. To the first person that calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
Yeah.
a few folks calling in. Let's... Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name an animal tune?
Oh, the lamb lies down on Broadway.
Very good. What is your first name, sir?
Phil.
Phil?
Yes.
Okay, cool, Phil. I'm going to put you back on hold and get your info in a sec, but we'll get you set up for tickets to the Southeast Women's Performing Arts Festival. Thanks for playing.
Okay, cool.
All right, so congratulations to Phil. Meanwhile, we're about to be joined by Linda Sheehan, who is the founder of Gulfport's Get Rescued event that's taking place this Saturday. So let's get right to speaking with her now. Linda, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. And as the founder of Gulfport's Get Rescued, I guess who better to answer? How did y'all come up with the idea initially?
Well, I have been in animal rescue for about 25 years, and my home is in Gulfport, and which is a very pet-friendly city. And so I thought, let's just talk to some friends and some merchants and all of that to see if we can't put something together like Gulfport does and have a animal rescue fundraising event.
And so did it... I mean, what was it like the first year or two as opposed to, I think this is the seventh annual, but I imagine you kind of start off a little more modestly than the extravaganza that people can look forward to Saturday.
Absolutely. My thoughts were, okay, let's talk with some friends and say, okay, let's do a little pet fashion show one Saturday and maybe do some, raffles and silent auction and just put it out there and see how many people showed up. And the very first year, 75 people showed up, and we just were having it on the sidewalk, and we were packed, and we said, okay, let's try this again. The second year, about 1,000 people showed up, and on and on, and we've had as many as 8,000 to 10,000 people who show up each year.
And at what point, Linda, did it evolve into kind of what almost seems like it's like the old ad, two events in one, because there's the daytime festival from 10 to 5, kind of on Beach Boulevard down to Gulfport, but then there's a whole nighttime component.
Absolutely. I have previously worked with different big shelter organizations, and they would put on these nice evening events where we'd have silent auction, live auctions, food, bands, etc. And I thought, well, this is the second opportunity for the rescues who wanted to get out and collect silent auction items and things like that. This is just a second attempt for them to make even more money. And everyone enjoys coming to the evening event. There's music and food and dancing and et cetera. And it's a lot of fun. So there's the people who want to bring their dogs during the day and enjoy a family festival event. And then there's people who want to come in the evening and have more of a party type atmosphere, and it just worked.
That's great. So something for everyone, and of course, I'm sure there's probably a good size contingent that goes to both.
Absolutely.
Well, cool. Well, I guess if people wanted to find out more, they could go to the website gulfportma.com, and I think also there's a phone number, if I'm not mistaken. Correct me if this is wrong, Linda, but I have 727-322-5217.
Absolutely.
Great.
We're also Facebook. You can search us on Facebook. Gulfport Get Rescued for the day event and Get Rescued Celebration for the night event. I know a lot of people on Facebook.
Absolutely. Okay, well, good luck to you. Sounds like it's going to be a blast, and thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, we've just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Again, we're now airing every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to noon, so we'll be back next Wednesday, March 2nd, when our guest will be Sherry Silk, Executive Director of the Humane Society of Tampa Bay, as well as Kathy Belton, Special Events Director there. And we'll get an update on what's been happening with HSTB, meet some adoptable pets, and hear about their forthcoming event, Bark in the Park, sort of the granddaddy of them in this area, if I'm not mistaken. That's going to be held March 5th. So I hope you'll join us next Wednesday for that conversation. And I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net. Keep an eye out for updates and announcements about the Talking Animals Festival. And again, if you'd like If you have a business, coffee joint, other things, go to a dog park, any number of things where we could send you one of these beautiful Talking Animals Festival posters, give us a call, 813-239-9663, or email us at dj@wmnf.org, or later on you could also email us at talkinganimals@wmnf.org, and we'll send you out one or more. If you know some folks who might also want to put some up, they're really beautiful. Again, you can check them out at talkinganimals.net on the festival page. And you can download a smaller version there as well. So we got you covered every which way with the posters. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott with All Souls version of It's the Music, airing Wednesdays from noon to 3. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune, one that Sandy Atkinson debuted at last year's Talking Animals Festival and may have written specifically for it. Either way, the Sandy Atkinson Band will be part of the festival lineup again April 3rd at Lowry Park, perhaps playing this song. And so it's Sandy Atkinson now with Talking to the Animals, taking us up to the NPR News, and then Scott Elliott and his great, great show right here on WNF Tampa. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next Wednesday. Talking Animals.
I was strolling through the jungle and what did I see? A great big tiger staring right at me. I said, here, kitty, kitty, and he jumped up and roared. Well, thank God you're here, cause I was so damn bored. And talking to the animals. Talking to the animals, talking to the animals, and they all talk to me. Just about that time, I met a cute little chimp. I threw him a banana, and away he went. Then he turned around and gave me a great big smile. See you later, alligator, and a wild crocodile. And talking to the animals, and they all talk to me. Watching the babies, they were loving that. I said, hey, sweet mama, now you're real hip. She said, the water is fine, come on and take a dip. And talking to the animals, talking to the animals, talking to the animals, and they all talk to me. They gonna talk to you, and talking to the animals, talking to the animals, talking to the animals, and they all talk to me. Well, I'm talking to the animals, talking to the animals, talking to the animals. We'll be right back.
right. That's Sandy Atkinson talking to the animals, which will be happening again April 3rd. Well, all kinds of people will be talking to and about the animals, Talking Animals Festival, Lowry Park, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. All right, stay tuned for NPR News and then Scott Elliott. Thanks.